So I'm not going to lie, this morning the sermon is not what I planned it to be. I changed it, and the reason I changed it is, and I might not even know this if my dad hadn't been staying with me this week, but my father is an aficionado of Fox News, and so Friday morning I turned on Fox News, and I'm greeted with Supreme Court has overturned Roe v. Wade. I was like, oh my goodness, okay. So boy, there's some good sermon material. And I'm not, I want to be clear, because you guys know I'm not a big fan of getting into politics on stage. That's not, I don't think that's the church's job. And so I'm not going to get into the political ramifications, and I'm not going to get into the law. As a history teacher, if you want to know what I think about Roe v. Wade as a history teacher, feel free to take my class at Pitt. It's at 8 a.m. Tuesday and Thursday. And I'll be happy to lecture you on the finer points of constitutional law. But for our purposes this morning, what I want to talk about is really the reaction that I saw both on television and on social media in the hours following that decision. And so what I want to do this morning is preach on a message which is ironically the text that follows what we talked about last week in Mark chapter 2. And this is the calling of Matthew, or Levi as he is called in the book of Mark. And I want to look at how Jesus viewed the lost and how Jesus viewed sinners, and maybe do some comparison and some contrasting with how the church today looks at people who do not share our particular view on things of faith. And so we're gonna start this morning in verse 14. And if you've seen The Chosen, you've seen a really good depiction of this. But if you haven't, you're just going to have to use your imagination this morning. So I want you to imagine this morning, you are one of Jesus's disciples. Maybe Peter, Andrew, James, or John, one of the guys that Jesus has previously chosen. You've been doing some traveling with him already. You have become convinced that he is the Messiah. And so you are following him. And you're not really sure what he's going to do yet. You're probably thinking a new Israeli empire is going to emerge, but you're not 100% sure. And so this transpires. It says, as Jesus passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me," and he got up and followed him. Now, it's important to note here as we look at this text, context is everything, and so understanding what a Roman tax collector, more accurately, what a Jewish citizen working for the Romans as a tax collector, how that person would be viewed by other Jews. Now, however much you may dislike the IRS, you don't dislike them as much as Jews disliked Jewish tax collectors. If you were a Jewish tax collector for the Romans, you actually made your profit by cheating your fellow Jews. That's how you made money. Your job was to bring in tax revenue for the empire. And anything you brought in over the conscribed amount, you got to keep. So the bigger cheat you were, the wealthier you got. Okay? And so not only were you seen as a collaborator and a traitor for working with the occupation force that was the Roman Empire, but if you had amassed any amount of wealth, the assumption by your fellow Jews was that you had made that money by cheating your people. Now, if you're wondering what the penalty is for collaborators, you need look no further than how French collaborators in World War II who collaborated with the Vichy government in France that the Germans had set up, those people were mistreated terribly when that war was over. If you're inclined to not care about what happens in Europe, then you can go back to our own American history and see how the Tories were treated in the colonies at the conclusion of the American Revolution. Now, when I did my genealogy, I got into the genealogy stuff, and I found out that my people, when they came from England, the branch that came from England, were Woodlands. That was our name. We were Woodlands, which I assume means we lived in the woods. My great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was born Samuel Woodland, and he died Samuel Woodley. And guess when he changed his name? During the American Revolution. You know why he changed it? Somewhere in his head, Woodley sounded more colonial than Woodland. And he did not want to be confused as a Tory, because the Tories got mistreated terribly by the colonists. Okay? So when you were viewed as a collaborator throughout history, things did not go well for you. So with all that backdrop in mind, Jesus walks by this booth and here's this Jewish guy that we know is Matthew, but is identified by his proper Jewish name Levi in this gospel. Jesus stops and looks at him, and when he stopped and looked at him, what do you think the apostles, the disciples that were following Jesus, what do you think they thought Jesus was going to do? Rebuke him, strike him down? Roxanne, what were they going to do? Smite him. Maybe Jesus is just going to smite this guy. Maybe he's just going to fall over dead in his booth as a sign to others who would betray their people for the Romans, because that's the kind of thing that a Messiah would do. So I want you to imagine for a minute their shock and dismay when Jesus looks at this guy and goes, "Hey, why don't you come be one of us, one of them?" He says, "Follow me." Now, in the immediate seconds after that, maybe this is what the disciples were thinking. He ain't going to follow us. He's not going to follow Jesus. He's a collaborator. He's a Roman sympathizer. He's betraying his own people. He's not going to follow Jesus. So what do you suppose happened when Matthew got up, walked out the tax booth, and just, okay. Any of you ever come home to find out that your spouse has invited people over to your house that you don't like? "Hey, guess who's coming over for supper tonight?" "Why? I invited them." "Why? Why would you bring those people over here?" "I hate them." Maybe just to irritate you, you know? Maybe you've been in a place where you walked in and you came in late and the only seat was next to somebody you didn't particularly like. Some of you are sitting there going, looking around the church this morning like, is he talking about me? I don't know, you know? But you guys get this idea. How are Peter, now, and by the way, in The Chosen, they do a great job of depicting that Matthew might in fact have been the tax collector that Peter, Andrew, James, and John had to pay their taxes to. That just makes it even better. That image was fantastic, by the way. And so you guys can get the idea here that Peter, Andrew, James, and John, and probably these other disciples are probably agitated by this. And then Jesus tells them the real good news. "We're going to his house tonight." Woo-hoo-hoo. Yeah. So in verse 15 it says, "And it happened that he was reclining at the table in his house," and that's Matthew's house, Levi's house, "and many tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many of them, and they were following him." Okay. Now, let's just be clear about this. When your particular brand of sin is so egregious that it has its own designation, who was there? The tax collectors and sinners. You're so bad, you're not even included with the sinners. You have your own designation. You've got your own designation. Man, that's pretty rough. That's how bad these people were viewed. They were not even seen as just average sinners. Your average sinners were probably your prostitutes, your adulterers, you know. But the really bad ones were the tax collectors. And so if we could go back a previous slide. I want you to get this idea. And it happened that he was reclining at the table in Matthew's house with many tax collectors and sinners dining at the table with him. Now I want you to be honest for a minute. If you and let's not drag me into this. So think of some other minister that you've gone to church with, and you went somewhere, because I don't want to drag me into this, but you went somewhere and you saw your minister talking to someone who was known to have a sinful, bad reputation. What would you think? Can you imagine what would happen if you went somewhere, like you were driving some part of Greenville, on the seedier side of Greenville, and you saw your minister standing on the street corner talking to a hooker? That's why I didn't want to drag me into this. You're welcome, Gwen. That's why I'm here, Gwen, to give visuals. That's my job. Now, let's be honest for a minute. How many church people would look at that and go, look at that, my minister's doing evangelism. Heck yes. That's what I'm talking about. That's the kind of minister I like. Look at this guy out here trying to do evangelism. No, most church people would be on their cell phone before they rounded the corner. Our preacher's talking to a hooker. Somebody call an elder, right? Am I wrong? No, I'm not wrong. You know I'm not wrong. That our mindset, this is what's happened to us. And it's not that different than the reaction of the religious people in the day of Jesus. The thought process is, at all cost, we need to keep Christian people away from sinners. We don't want them around us. We don't want that their sinful aura. I kind of picture Pigpen from Charlie Brown. We don't want that sinful aura that's around them to get on us, right? I've heard Christian parents, well-intentioned, say things like, "No, I don't want my kids playing with those kids down the street because those people don't go to church." Have you ever heard a Christian parent say that? So who's ever going to invite those kids to church if none of the Christian parents let the Christian kids play with those kids? Who invites them to church? The other sinner kids who get to hang out with them? Is that how that's supposed to work? But that is the mindset that we've kind of developed in the church over the years. And it's not a new thing. This is how the church, this is how the Jews looked at sinful people dating all the way back to Jesus. When you think about what's going on here, you've got this calling where Jesus is called Matthew, and Matthew runs with a sinful crowd. And so Jesus is called Matthew, and so of course, when Matthew decides to follow Jesus, what's the first thing Matthew's going to do? He's going to tell all his friends. Well, who were all his friends? The sinful people. And so Matthew has Jesus over to his house, and he invites all his sinner buddies over. Okay? So you've got this dinner invitation that is taking place, and all these people have come. And so it says Jesus, and by the way, does it sound to you like Jesus is uncomfortable here? What's he doing at the table? He's reclining. He's just chilling out. He's laid back, sitting there, and there all the sinners are in the room with him, and Jesus is like, this is great. How uncomfortable do you think Peter, James, and John were? They're like, man, lightning's going to come down and hit this room any minute now, and we're all going to die. And they're looking at Jesus, and does anybody in this room envision that at this moment some of these followers of Jesus might be reevaluating if he's really the Messiah? Because if he was really the Messiah, where would he not be? He wouldn't be reclining at a table with a bunch of tax collectors and sinners. And then this great little thing that Mark puts at the end of this verse, he says that Jesus, the tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples, and then and there were many of them. There's a lot of them. All right, let's go to the next verse, verse 16, all right? So now, the typical expected response from the religious people of the day, when the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?" So that's the question, right? Why is he eating with them? So as we sit in this room today, and we start to think about our role as the church, and we think about what are we called to do? Are we called to have fellowship with quote unquote these people? And what is that fellowship supposed to look like? And what are we supposed to do? And if I go out and I start hanging out with people who are not as righteous as I am, or not as faithful as I am, or unchurched is a word we like to use sometimes. You know, are other people going to look at me and ask, why are you hanging out with those people? What are you doing? Why are you spending time with those people? What's wrong with you? And that was what the religious leaders of the day were saying. They come in and they see Jesus like, what is... And they ask the disciples, and the disciples, by the way, probably don't even have a good answer. We don't know. Why is he doing this? Now, let me ask you a question. How many of you think that you are empathetic? That you tend to have pretty good empathy for other people who don't think or act like you do? So let me throw this question out to you. Now, I want to be clear. I want to be abundantly clear, because I have learned over the years that if I don't quantify these things before I say them, people will leave and they will say, "You know what Stuart said this morning?" And it's not what Stuart said at all. So let me just go ahead and give the tagline, the teaser. I am as anti-abortion as it gets. I think Roe v. Wade was bad legislation when it was passed 50 years ago. Okay? Let me just put that out there. But let me ask you a question. What do you suppose is the reaction to this decision for a 17-year-old girl in a state which has these trigger laws where now abortion is totally illegal as of Friday, who just found out last week she's pregnant? And the guy who's the father wants nothing to do with it. And she's terrified of what her parents are going to do to her. And she's terrified of the stigma. And she's terrified of how she's going to take care of this child and what's going to happen to her. Are you worried about that at all? Now, some of you are going, "It doesn't matter. Murdering that child should never be the answer." And that's fine, because you're not the one dealing with the problem. And I'm not, and by the way, I'm not saying, and some of you going, "So Stuart is pro-abortion. I knew it." That's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just asking you the question. Have you stopped to consider how this is going to impact that kid? And let me ask you a question. Do you think the church is going to be there to help her? This is one of the things that we need to remember as the church, that when we want to flex our righteousness in front of people, we need to be prepared to deal with the consequences of that. I had a couple that came to me one time. They asked me if I'd do their wedding. And I said, "Yeah, I'll do your wedding." I said, "Do you mind if I ask you a question?" They said, "Yeah." "No, you go right ahead." I said, why are you asking me to do it? They said, well, the church we go to won't do our wedding because we're living together. I said, okay. I said, if you agree to go through premarital counseling, I will do your wedding. So a couple days later, I get a phone call from the minister of the church that refused to do the wedding. And he said, we told them that they needed to separate. If they would live apart until the wedding, we would do the wedding. I said, well, did you offer them help? What do you mean? Well, what if they can't afford to live separately? Because guess what happens when you're living separately? Guess what happens to your bills? They double. How many of you could afford to double your bills right now? Two rent bills, two electricity bills, two phone bills, right? So now, some of you going, where's he going? I'm not talking about the morality of this. I'm saying it's easy to tell people that what you're doing is unrighteous, and then we're like, but we can't afford to do it a different way. So let me ask you, what should the church do? Help them, right? Hey, if you're willing to do this, we'll help you. We'll find somebody to put one of you up, or we'll help you with the bills. We'll do whatever we need to do to make sure that you can be in a place before God when you get married that is pleasing to Him. We will help you. You think the church did that? No. They didn't do that. It didn't even occur to them to do that. That wasn't their problem. Look, your righteousness isn't our problem. Well, if other people's righteousness isn't the problem of the church, what are we here for? What's our purpose? And see, we live in a world today where it's easy to flex our righteousness and say, well, you know, and here's people's response. Well, she should never have gotten that condition. Now, I'm going to ask you a personal question this morning. I want you to answer it out loud. I just want you to think about it. How many of you, but for the grace of Jesus Christ, could have been in that same situation when you were 17? Some of you go, oh, and by the way, if a guy in here raises his hand, I'm going to rush the stage. And I mean, let's be honest, right? You know how many people are sitting in our churches today who didn't get in that situation simply because they were lucky? But they are more than happy to wag their finger at the people who find themselves in that situation and go, yep, that's what you get. I wish I had a dollar for every person I know who's driven drunk, who didn't get in a wreck and didn't get arrested. Any of you know anybody that's ever done that? They were lucky, right? That's what we say. They were lucky. They were lucky. I remember being a teenager and getting up one morning and turning on the TV and finding out that Lynn Bias, at a party celebrating his drafting by the Boston Celtics, had taken cocaine and had a heart attack and died. And everybody that knew him said it's the first time he ever did it. And guess what? Only took one. Why do you think Jesus is eating with these people? Huh? They needed him. They needed him. And you know what they didn't need from him? They didn't need a lecture. They didn't need him telling them that they were going to burn in hell. They didn't need that. What did they? And by the way, the Pharisees, they asked the question, right? Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners? Now, I want you to look at verse 17, because verse 17 is fantastic. And hearing this, Jesus said to them. So what did Jesus immediately do? I'm not letting my boys answer this question because they don't know the answer. My guys are probably asking the same question. So I'm not going to ask them. Don't let them answer the question. I'll answer the question. Hearing this, Jesus said to them, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. Now, listen to this. I did not come to call the righteous, but who? Sinners. Now, I want you to take a minute. And I want you to think really carefully about what that statement means. When Christ died on the cross and was resurrected and ascended to heaven, and he left his disciples to start the church, who's the church for? Sinners, right? Now, if you ask most people, you know what they'll tell you? Well, church is for the righteous. This is a gathering place and a country club for the righteous people, right? Now, isn't that what we've made it? This is a gathering place for the righteous, and you know what we want to keep out of here at all costs? Sinners. We don't want sinners in here. Sinners come in, they'll mess everything up, right? Now, some of you are going, well, that's not how I see it. And by the way, good for you if you don't. But just ask yourself a question. If you think, and by the way, sometimes it's not so much how we think about it as much as how other people think about it. How many of you know a person today who doesn't think they should come to church because they're not righteous enough? Any of you know anybody like that? I'll bet you $100 right now, everybody in this room knows somebody who doesn't think they should be at church because they're not righteous enough. Now, what does that say about the church? Can you imagine if Levi, now of course he didn't have a phone, so he couldn't call him, but imagine Levi goes to some guy's house, a buddy of his who's a tax cutter. He says, hey man, listen, we're having a party at my house tonight. I want you to come. Why? What's going on? Jesus Christ is good. I'm one of his guys now. I'm following him now, and he's coming to my place, and we're having a party. And this guy goes, I can't come. Why? Dude, I'm a tax collector. I can't be in Jesus' presence. I'm a tax collector, man. I'm not worthy to be in his presence. And he's like, yeah, I know. He said you were going to say that, and he told me to tell you he doesn't care. He wants you to come. I can't do it. How many of you think that Levi had friends who did not go to his house that night because they didn't feel worthy? I think it's almost a certainty that there was somebody who did not go to that house that night and hear Jesus speak to them because they didn't feel worthy. And so we look at the world we live in, and we look at the combative nature that's developed, and this mentality of it's us versus them. And we don't look at people of different beliefs as people we're here to minister to. We look at them as the enemy. We look at them as the enemy. And I don't know. Is that what Jesus wanted? Was that his purpose? Did he want us to think that way and to act that way? And again, it's really easy when we have events that take place like the one that took place Friday with the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And again, I'm excited. I'm hoping it's going to save a lot of unborn lives. But the reality is that there are some terrified people in a lot of states today who don't know what to do now. And my question is really simple. Does the church care? We want our victory. We want our victory. And we don't care what the consequences are. We won. We finally, after 50 years, we've defeated the enemy. But what do we care about those people who are in that situation now? What is the church going to do? Are we going to reach out to those people? Are we going to embrace those people and say, hey, look, we understand. You're scared. We get it. We understand that you're afraid. Let us help you. Is that our attitude? Or are we just looking at them going, ha ha, ha ha, we won, sucker. Do you think that's what Jesus Christ would have done? See, unfortunately, the Jesus that we represent sometimes is the Jesus who would have turned around and looked at Levi and go, you're going to burn. You're going to burn for what you've done to your people. You're going to burn for the way you've treated your fellow Jews. You're going to burn for collaborating with the Romans. You're going to burn. Is that the Jesus that we represent? I hope not. I hope that's not the Jesus that we represent. I hope that as a church, we represent a Jesus who looked at Levi and said, dude, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you were ever in a situation where you thought this was the right solution. You know, we don't know why Levi became a tax collector. How many of you have ever been so desperate for money that you considered doing something stupid? Any of you ever been bills piling up, money becoming a problem, and it was so bad, and you're like, I don't know how I'm going to pay the rent next month. I don't know how I'm going to afford to. I've got a kid, and I don't know where I'm going to find the money for the baby formula. Any of you ever been in that boat? And you're like, man, what would you do? What would you do to make sure your kid ate? How far would you go? We don't know what Levi's circumstance is. Scripture doesn't tell us. We don't know how. We don't know if Levi took this job because he just didn't care and he was a callous, mean somebody who just didn't care what he did to his people. Or what if Levi was so poor this was the only way he could see to feed his family? Have any of you ever thought that's why Levi became a tax collector? We don't know. But let me ask you this. Is it plausible that there were people in that room that night with Jesus that were only tax collectors because they had no other way to make a living? By the way, some of the women in that room who might have been prostitutes, do you think it's possible that the only reason they were in prostitution is because they had no man to provide for them, and that's the only way they could make a living? See, we sometimes are so quick to judge the sin that we don't stop to consider the circumstance. And that's not who Jesus was. And look, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that we should not identify sin as what it is. Okay? I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. But if you're in this room today and you've never made a bad decision because of the circumstances you found yourself in, raise your hand. Right. You've lied. Some of you may have stolen. You've cheated. You've done what was necessary, and in your mind you said, well, it's the circumstances, this is not who I am, but the circumstances led me to this situation. This is not who I want to be. And so what I want to do today is just remind you in the days and weeks that follow, as we see the ramifications of this decision play out, that as you engage with people at work, at the grocery store, or for God's sakes, on social media, as you engage with people about this, before you hit enter or before you open your mouth, think about what Jesus would say to these people. What did Jesus say to that room full of tax collectors and sinners? I don't know. What did Jesus say to that woman he caught in adultery and they brought before Jesus and they wanted to stone her? What was it Jesus said to that woman? Where are your accusers? Neither do I condemn you. And then what did he tell her? Go and sin no more. I think it's fantastic if you just are celebrating this decision. I totally get it. I understand it. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what I would suggest to you today is it is the church who wants to represent a Jesus that came for the very people who will be most impacted by this Supreme Court decision. How about we demonstrate a little kindness, a little empathy, a little mercy, and maybe even, I don't know, be problem solvers. People who are looking to help minister to people who are in a difficult situation. The praise team is going to come this morning and they're going to lead us in our communion song. And as they do that, again, I want to challenge you to really be cautious and think about how Jesus would speak to people in this circumstance. It is so easy and quick. You know, we see something and it just irritates us and we type it and hit enter, you know. And by the way, how many of you have ever won an argument on social media? Yeah, right. Here's the thing. You may have never won an argument, but you may have turned people off to the church. Think about that this morning. As we deal in a world with so many complex issues, we should always consider what Christ would do.